From True Africa, I'm Claude Renitsky, and this is Limitless.
There was an attempted assassination on Bobby where his driver died. When we saw that, we knew we needed to very quickly to start cutting something. We need to cut this film. We need to put it together. We need to do something. If anything happens to him, we needed to tell the world the story very quickly.
Welcome to Limitless, the podcast that asks the questions that matter for Africa. We're looking for African solutions to African problems. The Limitless podcast is supported by the U.S. Department of State and the Scenefire Foundation. My guest today is Moses Bwayo, a filmmaker from Uganda. His documentary feature on the musician turned politician Bobby Wine has been nominated for an Academy Award. I totally love Moses Bwayo and his vibe, and I know you will too. He's a dedicated filmmaker. He spent 5 years shooting the documentary. He's a brave man. He was arrested, imprisoned, and shot in the face with rubber bullets by police while filming. But first, a little on his documentary subject, Bobby Wine, the man who wants to be Uganda's president. Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, otherwise known as Bobby Wine. He's a musician turned politician and current leader of the National Unity Platform, NUP, and the People Power Movement. He has campaigned for hospital sanitization, malaria prevention, refugees' rights, and children's education, among other issues. He is the main opposition leader to President Yoweri Museveni's rule, running against him in the 2021 presidential elections. And he has been imprisoned and intimidated countless times for challenging a man who has been in power in Uganda since 1986. I spoke to Moses Bwayo about Bobby Wine and why he means so much to young people in Uganda. But we also talked about Moses' own path, how he was mentored by Mir Nayir, one of my favorite film directors, and what he sacrificed to bring Bobby Wine's story to the silver screen.
We are fighting for freedom. We are fighting for freedom.
This is an episode about the importance of telling stories and how imagining a different narrative can get you in trouble with the status quo. This is such an inspiring conversation. I really think you'll enjoy it. And fingers crossed, we'll soon see whether Bobby Wine, the People's President, wins the Oscar for Best Documentary. Moses Bwayo, welcome to Limitless Africa. It's such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Claude. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm honored. And, you know, I listen to your podcast, and thank you for all the great work you're doing in Africa and for spotlighting Africa. I think it's a great thing that, you know, Africa needs today. Thank you.
Well, it's great that we can have this conversation around the film,
yes.
Bobby Wine, the People's President. And when we were preparing for this, we realized that you and I have mutual connections. Our friend Mark Geddes, we have Soul Guy, people who are very big supporters of what you do. But let's go back to your childhood.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about how you grew up.
So, Claude, I was born in a village 5,000 feet above sea level in a village called Bududa. And it's on Mount Elgon, which is east of Uganda and west of Kenya. And growing up there, life was quite simple. And, you know, we didn't have much. We didn't have electricity. There was no running water. You know, life was very, very simple. And we, you know, we grew up getting water from the river. We'd wake up very, very early in the morning. You know, sometimes if you go late, you find like puddles of animals, you know, like that have come to drink water as well. So we'd go very early to get this water. And growing up there, I learned how to observe life and, you know, the aspect of community. And you know, there's something in Africa called Ubuntu, which is like living in communion, right? Living together, this togetherness. And in my language is Ubunu, which is which comes from Abanu, which is people, like a people, and Ubuntu, this brotherness, this camaraderie, this community aspect of Africa. I learned it early on in my life, and you know, I was in a, I grew up in a house with about 30 people in the house, you know. Uncles, aunties, and grandparents. So, you know, because we didn't have a radio or a TV, there was a lot of sharing of stories and passing on knowledge. So I really, you know, learned this aspect of storytelling. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to riff a little bit off of what you mentioned around Ubuntu, because even though I'm West African and my native language is Mina, you know, I was very much inspired by Ubuntu because one translation is, I am because you are, right? So it's not about me. It's really about the community.
It's about us.
It's about us, exactly. And so as you were growing up in this community, what led you to discover film or filmmaking or cinema?
So, yeah, I saw a TV for the first time when I was about 9 or 8 years old. And we had moved from the village to a more developed region called, district called Mbale, which is like a city in eastern Uganda. And my dad had been transferred to like a higher position, and he was now working with the government there. And there was a market close by, and I, you know, one time I was sent to buy groceries there. And, you know, we have this thing, this space we call Chibanda, and there are local cinemas that sit about 300 to 250 people. And in there, there's a TV at the front, and someone in the front, he's like a DJ or a VJ or something like that. We call them VJs, actually. So he has a mixer and a remote, and he will pause the TV and, you know, translate what's happening on the TV to the local language. And these spaces are built with tin roof and like wooden planks. So there were holes through that we could, you know, peep and peek through and see the TV. And I always was fascinated by the films that we saw there. But the very first film I saw was Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon. But yeah, you know, they showed many different kinds of films, and outside there would be like a big megaphone, and you know, there's sound like blasting from this thing, and the guy's busy like renaming the characters of the film, and you know, he adds some spice to it, so it's very interesting. Anyway, so that was my very first interaction with cinema, and it was Akira Kurosawa, and I've never forgotten that film until today. It's one of my favorites.
But you know what? When I think about you and I imagine you as a boy watching a Kurosawa film, that is the ultimate Japanese auteur making a very intellectual movie, Rashomon.
Yeah.
I would have thought you'd be more attracted to martial arts movies and films with action. You know, were you also into other kinds of films?
Yeah, I mean, yes, they would show, you know, like Jean-Claude Van Damme, you know. They would show Rambo. They would show... what's her name? The amazing American like martial arts actress, Cynthia Ruthrock. So we saw lots of those films, and also Indian cinema. There was lots of Indian films as well that we saw, and Japanese films, Kung Fu. And yes, that's when I saw Akira Kurosawa for the first time, and it was the first film I saw. And it stayed with me until this day. It's one of my favorite films.
So past your teenage years, now you're 19 and you're becoming a young adult, and you moved to Kampala, the capital of Uganda. You're studying at Kampala University, but you're also working as a portrait photographer. Can you tell us about those years as you're moving into adulthood?
So, you know, interestingly, I started... the courses I did in what the equivalent of, I think, college here in Uganda, we call it secondary school. So you do these courses that lead you to what you want to study in university. So what I picked, or what, you know, rather my parents and teachers picked for me, were courses to become an architect or an engineer. but
typical I African hate family it. Choices, right? A doctor, Thank engineer, you. Yeah.
I know, but you know, so you know, my parents wanted an engineer and an architect in the family, but I didn't like them. You know, my favorites actually in the courses were technical drawing and art, and you know, and I was very artistic early on, and I had a friend had gifted me a Yashica camera, and I shot a few pictures, and I felt like that's what I wanted to do, you know. Of course, I messed up the very first negative, you know, it was all blown out, everything was terrible, but the guy at the developing lab kind of showed me around, and, you know, that Yashica camera kind of introduced me to photography. I got a job at a portrait studio, and this wonderful photographer, Brian Semakade, had just returned from the UK, and he set up a studio in Uganda. And it was like a masterclass, really. He taught me how to have an eye, to look for moments and to observe, really. And, you know, also the technical aspects. So I picked up all those. And when my results came back, I wanted to study photography or filmmaking. And I told my parents, look, I know, you know, you want me to be an architect, but I think that's not what I want to do, you know? And there was a big family meeting, you know, and my parents reminded me of this photographer who every occasion, like every big occasion, comes home maybe 3 or 4 times a year. He will come home, take our pictures, and then give us an album in a month or so. And this guy has always had a bicycle as long as I can remember. So my parents were like, so do you want to be like that guy? You know, like, do you just want to have a bicycle in your life? Like, that's the life you want. I was like, no. I actually want to study cinema. We had a disagreement. I left home for like a week. I found a school, Kampala University, and they had this course where you would do mass communication. But in your third year, you could specialize in film and TV production. So that's what I did. I had looked around and there was no film school. There was no photography school. The ones that were available were in South Africa and they were so expensive. No one could afford them. My parents couldn't. So I did mass communication and then I went on to do film and TV, a postgraduate in film and TV production.
But let me stop you there because yes. As you're telling us about this journey into filmmaking, yeah. There is one moment that is the decisive moment for you, which is a chance yes, encounter yes. with Mira Nair, right? So yeah. I have to just say right now, I love Mira Nair. I love her yes. films, Salam yes. Bombay, Mississippi Masala, Monsoon Weddings. I met her in New York at a party and she's so interesting and so generous. Tell us about how you met her and how she ended up taking you under her wing.
So after this postgrad in film and TV production, I wanted to learn the technical aspects of filmmaking. The course I had done was very theoretical, going into like, you know, early cinema, the Hollywood system, you know, the new waves, you know, the English new wave, Buñuel, studying the auteurs, David Lynch and Jean-Luc Godard, you know. Anyway, so I wanted some technical aspect and I saw this program that was being run by Maisha Film Lab and Mira had set up this, I think today, it's about 15 years ago is when she set it up. And I had noticed that African or Ugandan films had terrible sound. So I went and I joined as a sound recordist because I wanted to improve the sound in our films. So I did that and then I went back, that was in 2013 or 2011 when I did the very first training. And I went back, I did the same training in 2013 as a cinematographer. And that's when I met Mira. She was at that film lab. I was then selected as a sound recordist on her short film, A Fork, A Knife and a Spoon. She then, you know, told me she was working on a film that, you know, Queen of Katwe that she was going to make very soon. And that's when she took me under her wing. It was like another really heavy masterclass for me, Queen of Katwe. And we, I went on from shooting, casting portraits for the actors to, you know, shooting the tapes, working with Mira when she was working with the actors, you know, when they were training and things like that. And she would direct me a bit and, you know, move around the scene, you know, shoot it. And, you know, of course, I was on set as well as a PA in the sound department and second boom. And I came to New York for the very first time in 2016, leaving the African continent for the very, very first time. During the New York blizzard. I think it was the coldest it had been in 100 years.
And what was that like? Tell us about those first few days in New York. Tell us a bit about that before we get back into film.
So, Claude, it was like it was like a film. Until today, it's a very surreal moment when I land at JFK, because it brings back those memories of landing, you know, during a snowy winter. It was, the snow was falling. It's a very vivid memory that I have. I was experiencing snow for the first time. It was very cold, you know, but I had such a great time. We were sound mixing at Soundtracks New York. I saw how they were crafting the film again in post-production. And, you know, it was like a big journey of learning cinema. The whole process was a big masterclass. And I was staying with Mira on Riverside Drive on Upper West Side, Manhattan. And the whole experience was like a film, you know. I would walk out of the snow and you see this surreal city transports you to like 1900s America. You know, the architecture is just so interesting. So, yeah, I had such a lovely time in New York and I learned so much. I must say the cultural shock hit me when I returned to Uganda.
But then when you return, you actually set up your own production company. Can you tell us about Zsa Zsa Productions?
Yeah, so three friends of mine, Patience Asaba, Nikisi Serumaga, and Joseph Sozi, we set up a production house. And these are all Maisha alumni. They've all gone through the program by Mira Naya. We had met, you know, on set of Queen of Katwe, and then we, you know, we reconnected. And when I went back home, I wanted to take back all the knowledge that I had acquired, you know, and the experience I had gotten through the process of making Queen of Katwe back to Uganda. So we set up a production house, you know, Zsa Zsa Productions. The Ugandan film industry is so young. It's a very virgin industry. It's really starting to kick off now as we speak. But we were one of the pioneers that improved the films, the quality of films that were being made, you know, paying attention to sound, color.
But then, now we're finally getting into the main topic.
Yeah.
The film, Bobby Wine.
Yes.
So first, before we even get into the film,
yeah,
why don't you tell us who Bobby Wine is? I think it's very important for our listeners to have the full context.
Bobby Wine grew up in the ghetto. He grew up and he lost his parents very early on as a young man in the ghetto. And there's this saying in the US that they say, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And Bobby literally pulled himself up by the bootstraps in the ghetto, paying his way through school, you know, so educating himself and then, you know, going to university, doing a course in MDD, music, dance and drama, and then becoming one of the top three musicians in East and Central Africa, going on to win accolades, going on to become a celebrated R&B artist in the region. He had just, in 2005, he had bought this flashy vehicle, an Escalade, 2005, you know, it was the latest vehicle.
It's like one of those big SUVs, yes. Right? That everybody notices when you're riding down the street.
Thank you. Huge SUV, spinning wheels, you know. So he had parked at this nightclub, you know. He's feeling good. The girls are all around him. And then one guy came over and smacked him in the face, you know. Bobby refers to this moment as he was smacked into into consciousness. You know, he usually says this. So when this individual smacked him, Bobby wanted to like stand up for himself, and this person drew a gun on his face and told him, look, you cannot, you know, floss around in the country like you don't know that this country has its owners. This individual told him, there's people that own this place. You cannot act like you do not know. So the next morning, he showed up at a police station to report this case, and they told him that individual was a son of a military general in the country. And that's when something happened to him, that even if he had acquired this success, this wealth, you know, wonderful family, built a life for himself, there's not so much he could do. He was like any other person. His rights could be, you know, trumped upon by anybody. So that's when he's changed his music style from just entertainment, and he calls this style edutainment. Entertainment, but educational. So from then to now, Bobby's music became revolutionary music. He always started responding to misrule in Uganda with a song. So, but when in 2017, when he realized that the music could only comment on the situation, he wanted to act on the situation. So he decided to get involved in politics, and he's famously quoted saying, the parliament has refused to come to the ghetto, so the ghetto has come to the parliament. So him, as the then ghetto president, came to the parliament to represent the common man in the parliament. You know, when he made this switch and he was, you know, speaking not just as a politician, and indeed he says, you know, he's not a politician and he doesn't want to be described as such, because he says he's a Ugandan who is tired of the situation and wants change and knows the kind of change that he wants. And, you know, that was the reality of most of the young people in Uganda. But we just didn't have a leader. We didn't have a leader who was charismatic. We didn't have a leader who was unifying the whole nation. He was asking all the youth to get involved in the goings on in the country. He was asking us all to get involved in the politics of our country. He was saying politics cannot be left to the politicians. He was saying everything, all our lives rotate around politics. So in Uganda, Uganda is the second youngest country in the world, with 85% of the population being under the age of 35. So it's a very, very young country. And the young population majorly has been alienated from politics. So young people don't participate in politics. And I was one of those young people. When Bobby Wine put his foot in politics, transitioning from music into politics, he was asking all of us to get involved. Bobby was speaking to my heart, and a lot of the population, the youth of Uganda, many who were like me at that time. So here was a young man putting everything at risk. You know, he had built a great life. He didn't have to do this, but here was a young man. He's put everything on the line, and he wants to lead a revolution. He wants to lead the young people dreaming of a different future. I felt like, you know, there was something here. This was something happening before me. This was a very rare time in the history of our country that there was a young individual taking a chance, right? So I was, you know, I started thinking, and I was like, this could be a great film. And around the same time, a friend introduced me to my co-director and producer, Christopher Sharp, who said he had just met Bobby in Malta, and Bobby told him, look, I just, you know, I'm a musician, but, you know, I just recently got elected into parliament, and I'm now, you know, looking to change the status quo, to challenge the status quo. So
let me ask you, in challenging the status quo, clearly in Uganda, that means challenging Museveni, right, who has been in office since 1986.
Yes.
Was Bobby thinking at that time that, given that Uganda is the second youngest population in the world, he could build a strong political base by just speaking directly to the youth with his edutainment style? Is that what Bobby was thinking when he was an MP looking for higher office?
So initially he wasn't thinking of a higher office. Initially he just wanted to unify the opposition. But while he was on, you know, he got into parliament at a time when there was an impending age limit debate. The president, the incumbent president now, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, was changing the constitution to run for another term. He was removing the final.
The term limit, right? He was changing. He was removing the final hurdle to the term limit in the amendment of the constitution, right?
So he removed the term limits in 2005. Now he was removing the age limit.
Got it.
You know,
got it.
To allow him to have a lifelong presidency, right? So the big challenge was, you know, he was. So this debate was very heated, really led by Bobi Wine, and he was saying, "Look, we don't have to allow this to happen because we're going to hurt our country and the future of our country. This is the only chance we have to a peaceful transition of power." You know, General Museveni has been in power for 38 years. Uganda has never had a peaceful transition of power since independence in 1962. The first 24 years saw coups. General Museveni and his henchmen formed a rebel group, which he led a guerrilla war, which lasted 5 long years, and it was one of the most brutal wars that we've had in Uganda, where over 500,000 Ugandans died. So General Museveni came into power promising a return to democracy, promising all these wonderful things that he wanted to do. But
let's interrupt you, but that's really around the time that people were hoping to transition away from the whole kind of Idi Amin situation that came out of Obote and everything else. So this was a new dawn, right?
Thank you. So Museveni's government was seen as a new kind of, you know, like a democratic government that was coming into power. They were coming to change things, you know, and they had overthrown Obote and Idi Amin and Tito Okello Lutwa and all the other, you know, the former dictatorships, you know, that came through coups. So Museveni was seen as a diplomat, as a democrat. But when he came into power, he quickly took a grip on things. And of course, the early years of President Museveni were very successful. You know, Uganda was one of the you know, darlings of the West. So think about it. Since Ronald Reagan, Uganda has had the same president until today. And I think just that is enough for us to think, oh my God, you know, what's happening? This is the 21st century. Anyway, so in 2017...
Well, when you say that, before we talk about 2017, when we talk about 38 years, I mean, I'm from Togo, and General Iadema was in office for 38 years.
Wow.
So it's crazy for me to think that Museveni is going to be in office longer than Iadema, which really was already like such a long... ruling period. So sorry, let's get back to the film because I digress.
No. Claude, look, your reference is totally correct. And you look, you got this story, our film, yes, it's about Uganda, but it is the story of so many nations around Africa. And this is a big problem that as peace-loving Africans, you know, as Africans who are progressive and want to see Africa grow, one of the challenges that Africa needs to deal with is the governance question, because governance affects everything. You know, we need to have governments that empower the youth, governments that create opportunities, governments that are not bent on longevity and entrenchment into power, but governments that build the youth for tomorrow, to become leaders of tomorrow. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Let's get back to the film and the director and how the two of you and Christopher connected.
Yes. So, we were introduced by a friend in 2017, and indeed, you know, Christopher came to Uganda to put together a team to work on the film. And he reached out, and I felt like, wow, this is such a great opportunity to document this moment in history that our country, that the young people in our country were dreaming of a different future. So I quickly said yes. I loved Bobby's music. I had met him briefly at a screening of Queen of Katwe. He was his music was featured in the film. So we met briefly at the premiere of Queen of Katwe in Kampala. But then we were now being introduced as, you know, me working on his film, on you know, documenting him. So from 2017, for the next 5 years, I was following Bobby almost every day of the week. I was with him. Yeah.
You were, in a sense, shadowing him. And, you know, you were also shot in the face at close range when you were filming this. So you want to tell us about the personal risks that you took? Because for your pains, you put your life in danger as well, didn't you?
Yeah, so in the beginning, as we started working on this film, you know, the violence was being meted upon politicians and their supporters. Very quickly, as we headed to the election, not just myself alone, but many other journalists, some have also had to flee the country. So I was arrested. I was arrested a couple of times. I was locked up in jail. I was interrogated. And I was shot in the face at close range, close to the election. And before we fled the country, there were two attempted kidnaps on my wife. And when that happened, Christopher Sharp, my co-director and producer, and John Batsek and myself, we decided that before we could release the film, I had to leave. Myself and my wife, we had to flee the country and find a safe place, a safe haven, for lack of a better word. Now we live in the U.S. and we are here seeking political asylum.
Where in the U.S. are you living with your wife and family?
Yeah, we now live in Los Angeles. Yeah. The way we left the country, we left on a very, you know, in a hurried way, you know, like we were in a hurry as we left with, you know, little bags, like we were going on a trip to Europe. And we connected through Amsterdam to the US. This film has been a labor of love. It's been a great collaboration, between myself, Christopher, and, you know, John Batsek, and of course Bobby Wine and Bobby, and the people of Uganda. You know, we hope that you know, every level of attention that we receive is a lifeline. It is a lifeline for the Ugandan people. It's a lifeline for Bobby Wine, who continues to fight the dictatorship back home.
Let me ask you, yes. You've got some heavy hitters that you just mentioned behind this film. You know, John Batsek, he's won 2 Oscars. He's a very famous and successful producer. Mm-hmm. You have people like my friend Soul Guy, that we spoke about, who's, you know, a great, very talented filmmaker himself.
Yeah.
Obviously, your co-director, Christopher.
Yes.
Why do you think these heavy hitters were interested in that particular story of Bobby Wine?
I think this story is a rarity, you know, to start with. Bobby is just, you know, these are characters you don't come by many times, you know. He gave up his own comfort to fight for freedom and democracy. And, you know, there's a saying that goes, bad things happen because good people don't do anything. When the situation in Uganda was deteriorating, people like Bobby Wine have stood up. And largely many Ugandans have stood up next to him, right? His supporters and the people in his political group, his political party, the NUP, National Unity Platform. And they've dreamt of this different, you know, this new Uganda, regardless of the oppression. And I think right there is a heroic story. And if you see our film, yes, it's a strong subject, but you leave inspired. You want to do something, right? You want to do something. So we had amassed a good amount of footage in 2018. And there was an attempted assassination on Bobby where his driver died, right? When we saw that, we knew we needed to very quickly, if anything could happen to Bobby, and forgive me for saying this, but Christopher and I, we thought Bobby might be killed. We honestly thought he might be killed.
I mean, the risk was very real. I mean, it wasn't just a perceived threat. It was a real threat.
It was a real threat. And indeed, by the time we finished filming in 2022, there had been 7 attempted assassinations on his life. So I'll just backtrack, and you know how John came into the picture.
John Batsek, you mean? John Batsek, the producer. Okay.
Yes, the 2-time Oscar winner. He you know, we had gotten a bit of footage. There was an attempted assassination on Bobby's life. His driver died. You know, and he went to the US to get treatment, and we're like, my goodness. We need to start cutting something. We need to cut this film. We need to put it together. We need to do something. If anything happens to him, we needed to tell the world the story very quickly. We cut together a trailer, you know, with maybe it was a 10-minute trailer with some footage. And when John saw it, he was like, wow, yes, I will support you guys. I will see what I can do. And we needed, you know, another partner to come on board. And yes, Soul Guy with his company Quiet. It's been a great collaboration. And we hope that, you know, this story, you know, yes, it covers, it's the story of Uganda and the fight for freedom in Uganda. But largely, it is the story of how fragile democracies are. And today, in a world where we see a rise in totalitarianism, this film has never been urgent.
When you say that democracies are fragile, obviously we're thinking about it within the African context and the Ugandan context, but one could argue that even the United States is dealing with a fragile democracy right now. So
Thank you.
It's a very kind of tenuous balance, right? Keeping the people's will and balancing that with special interest. I'm wondering, now that you have completed the film, and apparently you and the team that were there presenting the film got a 10-minute standing ovation at the Venice Film Festival. What do you want people to know about this film? The reason I ask that is... This episode is being released right before the Oscars. The film has been nominated for an Academy Award, and it's a big deal.
Yes.
But it's not just about the award. What is it that you want people to know and remember about this film?
I would like people to know we are humbled by their attention. Extremely humbled. All every level of attention. And we didn't set out to make an award-winning film. You know, when I was in Uganda working on this, I was thinking about the events of the day, what was happening. I was trying to get out of those violent situations, right? I would like for people to know that this film is a lifeline. It's a lifeline. Every level of attention helps to highlight this story. It helps to highlight the struggle in Uganda, but largely, it helps to struggle to highlight the fragility of democracies around the world. And that's what this film does. It shows the world what it means to lose a democracy and what happens when you lose that democracy. And this is mainly to more established democracies that we all dream of. You know, these wonderful systems that we all want to have. These systems need protection, and we can all do something. We can do something. So every level of support, every level of attention is a lifeline. It's a lifeline to the people of Uganda. It's a lifeline to Bobi Wine, to his family and those around him.
You know, I was really surprised, given the commercial appeal of the film, potentially, to see that Nat Geo Documentary Films actually put the entire film on YouTube, so anybody can watch it for free.
Yeah.
Why do you think they did that?
So when we made this film, we also wanted to make sure it would be seen by the people on the continent, the Ugandan people, the African people. If you take out, from our story, you take Museveni out, you take this story, you take it to the Gambia, you put it in Central African Republic, you take it to Gabon, right? You take it to all these other countries, you will see that the character, you can change the characters, but the story is the same, The story is the same.
It really is.
It's the same story. It's not different at all, right? And now, with what's happening in Uganda, we worry that we might fall into the same chaos that Sudan is in right now. It's because these leaders who have stayed long in power have not created, they've not created they've not given the opportunity of a peaceful transfer of power.
I mean, I know about that. My own uncle, Gilchrist Olympio, was the leader of the opposition in Togo for many years, and he was shot when he was campaigning in the north of Togo. I mean, this is such a common story in African countries around election time, right?
Yeah, because they want to eliminate any threat to the establishment most times. But that's, that's where the dictatorships go wrong, because you remain with a militarized state. So when the leader dies, or when he's ousted through a coup, and then there's divisions in the armies, and then you run into the same situation like what we have in Sudan today. What we have in Sudan today for sure did not just happen, right? Omar al-Bashir was a dictator who had been in power, known as a dictator for a very long time. And again, the example in Uganda, Museveni has been known as a dictator for a very long time. So should we be surprised 5-10 years from now if Uganda descends into chaos? No, but we have a chance to change that right now. We have leaders like Bobi Wine. We hope that the world will not ignore the Ugandan struggle, right? If the world can stand with democracy-leaning leaders, maybe we'll have a chance. And Claude, on a larger perspective, most of the problems that we have in Africa today, I'll go back to the governance question. Most of the problems we have in Africa today, and the problems that are spilling over to other countries, and I mean things like immigration. We have a large population of Africans, young, able, well-educated Africans that are leaving the continent. They are leaving the continent because they have no opportunities on the continent. All the gaps, the opportunities they would, the environment that would allow them to thrive is non-existent. So they get onto these harrowing journeys on boats, so they are walking through the Sahara, or they get on ships and stowaways on planes to go to these Western countries with the hope that maybe life will be better, right? But the solutions can be found, are found in Africa. The solutions are within Africa, and it is a governance question. The moment we solve the governance question in Africa and open or have these opportunities for the African youth, Africa will thrive. Africa will be the heaven it should be.
I so agree with everything you're saying. I recently executive produced a documentary film called Blue Carbon, which very much deals with the migration issue and how so many young migrants from Senegal get on these rickety boats trying to get to Europe. And it's a really big story that we talk about often on the podcast. And it's interesting that you're now living in Los Angeles and I'm living in New York. But I believe what's really important is for mm-hmm. those of us who are privileged enough to have access to more resources and influential people and big institutions, it's also to be part of the solution and actually be perceived and be active as a bridge between the African continent and some of the resources and institutions that we are related to somehow in the West. So I think it's important to always stay connected with what's happening in the continent and not always just complain about the lack of governance, but also think of what we can do to help to solve some of these problems.
Yes, to leverage the opportunities that we have presented to us and see how we can use that to change things. I agree. I totally agree with you. And I think, you know, the solutions of Africans, yes, can be found. And we as Africans can find those solutions. And we need to pursue them. We need to engage, you know, more and think about the solutions. I agree with you. Think about what we can do to change things on the continent, you know.
And filmmaking is very important. Storytelling is very important because stories matter, especially documentaries. Real stories matter because it's important for people to be aware of what's going on. As we wrap up, I wanted to change the subject a little bit and ask you something related to what you were doing before, because I was really inspired by the story around the wonderful Mira Nair and how she took you under her wing. And that film, The Queen of Katwe, the question is, what was it like working with Lupita Nyong'o?
Oh, wow. It was wonderful. I mean, Lupita actually was I think she started off as Mira's assistant, actually. And at one of the Maisha,
I didn't know that. So that's how she got started. Oh, that's very interesting.
She did, yeah, and she was cast in a film. I think she did like two films in the Maisha labs. You know, the labs I went to where I was trained.
Yeah, the one you were talking about. Yeah,
she acted in the films at the labs and. Literally, that launched her into acting. Then she was at the Uganda National Theater. And then her career moved, you know, slow by slow. And you know, then she got into Hollywood. But yes, it was lovely working with Lupita Nyong'o on Queen of Katwe. She was very friendly. She was very approachable. And that was the same with David Oyelowo. You know, we
yeah, another great actor.
Very, very great actor. You know, we when they came on set, you know, of course, as a PA, you know, you don't know if you can engage or not. But then, you know, you're walking past and like, hi, Lupita. And she says, hi, back. I was like, are you okay? You know, and then you start talking and we became friends. We got to know each other quite well. Same with David, you know, he could talk to anybody. They were very friendly and very, very happy to share knowledge with the kids, the kids who were acting in the film. They were helping them, you know, helping them through the process. It was such a wonderful experience. I mean, you know, I think I said it before, but I'll just reiterate. Queen of Katwe for me was a big masterclass, and it opened a window into fiction filmmaking that I had never, you know, experienced in my life. So I definitely will be making some fiction films alongside the documentaries I want to make. Yeah.
Well, we really want to wish you the best for your documentary, Bobby Wine, The People's President. Again, I said it. We want as much support for this film as possible. Again, the Academy Awards, the Oscars is on March 10th, and we hope that you will win, and we feel that you deserve to win. And it's been great talking to you, Moses. Thank you very much for giving us so much of your time.
Thank you, Claude. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here and to share, you know. I love telling stories and I love to share, you know. So anytime you need me, I'm happy to speak. But yes, thank you for highlighting our film. Thank you for hosting me. Yeah, and you know, I want to just thank everyone who has supported us and who has gotten us this far. Documentary filmmaking is not an easy feat. It's a very collaborative process, and filmmaking in general. So we've not done it alone. We've had so many people help us and support us through the journey. We thank you all. You know, we are really humbled by the support. And thank you. Thank you. It's an honor.
Go to the Nat Geo YouTube channel to watch Bobby Wine, the People's President, for free and in full. To help other listeners find this conversation, please leave a review on Spotify or Apple. Even better, share this episode with any friends who are interested in filmmaking and inspirational Africans who are hopeful for a better tomorrow. You've been listening to Limitless. I'm Claude Grunitzky. The Limitless podcast is a production of True Africa. This podcast is made possible with a grant from the United States Department of State and the Scene Fire Foundation.